new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solar Topia is home sweet home to me.
Thank you, Dana Lyons, and thank you guys in New York for pulling that off. I hope we have Mark Daly with us. Mark, are you there?
Yep.
All right, Mark. Mark Daly, my good old buddy. I'm looking at a picture of you with a hat and a beard standing out at the Point Reyes Sanctuary with the ocean in the back. You look terrific. How you been?
Been fine. How you been, Harv?
Oh, I've been good. I'm good, actually. I'm in Central Ohio talking to you now on what is the coldest day in recorded history in Central Ohio. It is like about 8 degrees below zero. People are just freaking out. And, of course, everybody's running and saying, well, no more global warming, but, of course, we know it's all about global weirding. And when you screw up the environment, Mark, you get ultra-extremes. So you are still in that gorgeous place in Point Reyes National Seashore. Is that right?
Yeah, and I went to college 23 miles from where you are right now, and I remember some cold days there, but not that cold.
No, and you had a good sense to get the hell out of here, so hopefully I'll be out in a while, too. So you and I have taken some fabulous walks on the Point Reyes Beach. You still have that beautiful golden dog?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, good for you. And, Mark, I got to tell my listeners, you exercise every morning by getting in a kayak and going
on
the
it's a rowing shell.
Oh, it's a rowing show. Okay.
Yeah.
Pardon me. Are you still doing it every morning?
Every morning I can, yeah. You know, bad weather. I don't go out in bad weather, but, you know, when the weather's good, I do, yeah.
I can't even begin to. I'd love to be able to describe to my listeners how beautiful it is. You have a dock behind your place. You go out on Tomales Bay, which is undeveloped. I mean, you know, I saw a wonderful documentary film called Rebels with a Cause about how Northern California was preserved. And you live in one of the most beautiful places on earth, and I'm just trying to soak in talking to you from that area. Now, you are one of the great journalists of our generation, Mark Daly, D-O-W-I-E. You broke the story about the Pinto for Mother Jones magazine in God knows what year. What was it, 1843, something like that?
It was 1977, and you know something, Harv? I've written 200 investigative reports since then, and that's the one that keeps haunting me for some reason. It's not even my best work by far.
But well, tell us what is. What's your best work?
Oh, it's still to come.
Oh, all right, we like that. Absolutely. Well, you being a spring chicken, a young guy still with your knees and all that stuff, you are working on a very interesting project now. You have it on Inkshares, which I really don't know much about. So tell us first, Mark Daly, about your project, and then about Inkshares and how people can support it.
Yeah, my project is, I describe it as a strategic playbook for indigenous sovereignty. I've been spending a lot of time researching the history of an archipelago of islands south of Alaska called Haida Gwaii, which is the homeland of the Haida people. They've lived there for about somewhere between 10 and 13,000 years.
Can you spell that, Mark, before you jump ahead? Spell that, if you would.
Haida is spelled H-A-I-D-A. Gwaii is spelled G-W-A-I-I.
Okay. All right.
And it's a cluster. It's 130 islands, and they've been thriving on these islands for 10,000 years. They're really a remarkable nation of people. Their art is in every museum in the world. They have a written language, and they have a body of literature. A lot of things that are unusual for native people around the world. They're really extraordinary. Well.
How many people are there on this 130 islands?
Less than 3,000.
And it's all one tribe.
Yeah, it's the Haida. Yeah.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. All right, let's hear it.
For the last 50 years, they've been fighting against colonialism, imperialism, and the extractive industries of the world. It's a very, very lush cluster of islands. It's known as the Galapagos of the North because there's so many, such a variety of species. There are more species in Haida Gwaii than there are on the Galapagos. So it's really, really rich in fish and fur and timber and everything that the extractive industries want. So they've been plagued for years. For 150 years, they were just plagued with extractions of one sort or another. And they decided to fight against it, and starting about 40 years ago, really. They won in 2009. What were known as the Queen Charlotte Islands now became known as Haida Gwaii, which is what they'd always been to the Haida. And they were given by the Canadian Supreme Court, were granted land tenure, autonomy, and sovereignty. So it's a major, major victory for a small First Nation. And I believe that the way they did it could be used by any one of the 3,000 or 4,000 other native communities around the world that are struggling for sovereignty inside the nations that enveloped them 100 or 200 or 300 years ago.
So these islands are in Canada.
Yeah, Canada. Yes, right. Yeah.
Okay, and you're Canadian too, by the way, right?
I was born in Canada. Yeah, I live in Canada. I've lived in the U.S. most of my life, but I was born in Canada. Yeah.
But I know you well, and you don't say a boot.
My children teased me out of that.
Okay. All right, so tell us, how did they win? Tell us real quickly, because we're going to get, I don't want you to lose track.
It's a very long lecture, which I won't give you. Basically, but I'll tell you generically what they did. They used the right tactics in the right order. Most people who are protesting against larger powers and extractive industries and everything, they do it all wrong. They just go out and demonstrate, and they get a bunch of hippies to go and hold up signs for them, and they think, you know, that the public and the media and the courts and the government are going to come their way. It's not that simple. It took these people 40 years to do this, and they did it step by step by step. They used the courts at the right time. They used direct action at the right time. They exploited the media at the right time. They got the public involved, the environmental movement, but all their timing was perfect. And I now believe, by studying carefully what they did, that their model of winning sovereignty is transportable anywhere in the world. An indigenous tribe in Indonesia, in Kenya, Uganda, and Thailand, anywhere in the world can use these same tactics and win sovereignty. So I want to document what they did.
All right, well, tell us about your project and what you're going to do, and then we'll go back to the content here. So you are with a thing called Inkshare. What is that?
Inkshares is a... Inkshares is a publishing company, but it's crowdfunded, so it's like Kickstarter meets Random House. So you take a book idea to Inkshares. They like it. They'll say, okay, how much do you need, and what kind of a book do you envision, and what kind of a press run. So you work with them, and then you come up with a dollar amount, which includes what I need to go up to Haida Gwaii and what the cost of editing, the cost of designing, printing, and distributing the book, and they come up with a big number, right? In my case, it's $28,000. And they that includes everything. That includes everything, printing, everything. So they come up with that number, and I have to raise that amount through crowdfunding. And the advantage to doing it that way is that if I do raise the amount, the book gets printed, gets distributed by Ingram, the largest distributor in the world, and I get 50% royalties. So it's a new model of publishing that's very appealing to writers who have, as I do, a large enough following that they'll support a project like this.
What do these shares do for you?
They publish the book. And they distribute the book. They edit the book. They design the book. They print the book.
And do they let you have a say in the basic formatting and
absolutely. This book. Okay. This is my book, not their book. All they do is, I mean, I design the book. I say what art is in the book. I work with an editor, but the editor is not a commander, though, like most book editors are, that are, you know, the relationship of most book editors to the writer is the relationship of the knife to the throat. And I'm done with that. I don't need to do that anymore. I've done seven books.
You're not done that way.
I've done seven books that way, Harv. That's enough. Okay? So I like this model because the writer is in control of the book.
And so, well, now, but your editor is going to review what you write?
Well, my editor is an old friend of mine. She drew me into this. She will do the line editing and the copy editing and work with me on structuring the story and everything. But she's not the knife to my throat the way every other editor I've ever worked with is, right? She's a friend who loves the project, brought me in to do it. So I'm looking forward to it. I've worked with her many times over the years. She's an editor at Orion magazine, and I love her. She's great. We were good friends. We've worked together many, many times, and so it's going to be a good relationship this time.
All right. So then, what do you need from the public? What would you like to tell all the Solartopians listening to this show about how they can get your book published?
Well, if they go on to the InkShares website, and all you need to do is Google the word InkShares, right, plural, InkShares, you'll find the website, you'll find my project there. It's called The Haida Gwaii Lesson, or just look for my name, and everything you need to know will come up. So I don't want to give you a big, long string of Internet letters. Just do that. If you're really interested, go to the InkShare. You should go to the InkShare site anyway because it's a fascinating a book publishing thing, and you can see it all working on the site. It's very exciting, and there's some really interesting books being done there.
Like what? For example?
Well, they're just novels, good novels. So there's a new history of Winston Churchill that's on there that's really good. There's some... You know, it's whatever you like. It's a big publishing company. There's science fiction, politics, environment, everything that you're looking for is there in their growing catalog. And, of course, most of the catalog that you see now are books that are being funded and books that are in progress. They've only got about 20, 25 books actually in print now because they've only been in existence for a year.
In order to get this book published, you will raise funds on this crowd share, and then that money will be used to print the book, and then they will handle the distribution and the production of the book. Is that it?
Yeah, the book. The major shareholder in InkShares is Ingram. That's good news because Ingram is the biggest and most aggressive book marketer in the world, and so your book will be distributed and marketed by Ingram.
Cool. Good.
Yeah, great.
Well, I have my books published at Lightning Source, but I designed them myself, and I, you know, like you, I had enough of editors. Although I had a couple of good editors,
I did too. And Jennifer Son, who's my editor at InkShares, is one of the good ones.
I can count on one hand
the editors I ever want to work with again.
Yeah. Well, I had one at Harper & Row, Hugh Van Dusen. He was terrific. And then I had one at Dell named Gary Luck, and he was terrific. Beyond that, I had Jeff somebody at McMillan, but they're gone. So I haven't done that for many, many years. I've been printing my books myself. Distribution's a problem, though. So are they going to? How are they going to distribute your book? Are they going to advertise it and push it, or is that up to you?
How did Ingram become the largest book distributor in the world? How do you think they did it? They know what they're doing. I don't know what they're doing, but they know what they're doing because they became the largest book distributor in the world. So I just rely on their track record. I don't care how they do it.
Okay. All right, so Inkshares, we've done that. Now, let's go back to the Haida Gwaii. Tell us as much as you can, or you're willing to, in the last 10 minutes that we have about what their relationship to the land is like and how they've protected themselves.
Well, you know, like so many surviving indigenous tribes and communities in the world, these people are very, very close to the land. I mean, they consider themselves relatives of the wildlife on the island. And the wildlife is amazing. I mean, there's endemic species there. The largest black bear, subspecies of black bear in the world is on Haida Gwaii. Now, ask yourself how the hell that happened. How did the most animals that end up on islands get smaller, right? But here's this black bear that somehow got onto an island 50 miles off the coast of British Columbia and bred itself up to be the largest black bear on the planet. So go figure that one out. That's one of the big mysteries of Haida Gwaii. There are many mysteries.
Well, they were protected.
No, Harvey. No, that's not how it works. You know,
okay.
If you shrink an ecosystem, generally most of the species in that ecosystem will diminish in size. It defies that rule of nature. So nobody understands why this happened. Nobody does.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff in the Galapagos, too. And in any island ecology has a lot of really unusual stuff going on. I mean, like Madagascar has all these lemurs that don't exist anywhere else on the planet. Amazing creatures, right? Amazing, beautiful creatures. And there's some like that in Haida Gwaii. There's a lot of, in the Galapagos. So it's an interesting ecosystem, and it's studied by wildlife biologists from all over the world. Spend a lot of time in Haida Gwaii studying the wildlife there. It's amazing.
So you said it's 100 and some islands, 150 islands?
Yeah, it's 150. About 130 of them are habitable. The rest of them are just rocks in the middle of the Pacific, right?
But how much, how wide and deep is the geographical area that these islands are spread over?
Well, on the coastal side, the water is just at normal depth. It's actually a little bit shallower than most coastal water, and it's actually very treacherous water because of the combination between the weather, the currents, and everything. It's very treacherous to get over there from the mainland. On the other side of the island, it drops off to 3,000 feet almost immediately, and it's one of the best fisheries in the world. And which has made it attractive to big fishing, right? So big fishing is there, big fur is there, big timber is there, big tourism is everybody big that wants a piece of this incredibly beautiful and fecund and productive place is there. And they've had to fight them back, you know, for years. And without the help of the Dominion of Canada, without the help of the province of British Columbia, they've just had to fight them back, and they have. They're a very, very ferocious and militant people, but militant like Martin Luther King was militant. He was nonviolent militant, but they've stood their ground.
How are they educated? How are they educated?
Self-educated. I mean, they pass their tradition, like all indigenous people, they pass their traditions on through oral stories. Which they do not like anthropologists and people like me to come in and steal, which I don't and I won't. But as I said earlier, they're one of the few indigenous tribes in the world that have a written language, very sophisticated written language, and a body of literature in that written language. So they've educated themselves over 10,000 years. And they're remarkably well educated. I've got pictures of them at the turn of the 18th and 19th century sitting around with books in their hands, right? How often did you see that in the world in the 18th and 19th century? Not very often. So they're they're educated in the canon. I mean, there are a lot of people up there who've read Aristotle and Plato and can cite them. So they're amazing people, amazing people.
When did they develop their own written language? Do you know the history of it?
Yeah, gradually over the years. If you look at it, it's kind of it looks like a Cyrillic language, and you know that was all part of Russia at one point, and you know Russian. They may have originated, or Russians came and taught them. Nobody really understands it. It's a Cyrillic-looking language. It's not like the Anglo alphabet at all.
Because you know, the Cherokee are famous for having they actually commissioned a member of their tribe, whose name was Sequoia, in the middle 1810s to devise a written language for them.
Yeah,
because they were confronting the whites, and they needed a constitution and a newspaper, and so this guy in 2 years, Sequoia, was paid by the tribe, and he invented a 28-character written language. To my mm-hmm. knowledge, it was the first in North America. But you're saying that this evolved over a longer period of time among the Haida Gwaii.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, Harv, I don't know exactly how it originated and how it did, but you've raised a question which I will know the answer of the next time we talk, and that is, you know, the historical origin of the Haida language. But I do know it's their own. They developed it themselves. It's very complex. There is a dictionary of Haida, Haida to English dictionary, which I do have, but the origins of the language and the evolution of the language itself is a good question. I'll have to ask Noam Chomsky or some.
Well, now, do they have an elected government?
Yes. Very, very democratic. Like the Iroquois, they've always been very democratic. And, you know, and like most cultures in the world, it was more patriarchal than we would have liked, although it's matrilineal, like a lot of native cultures. It's patriarchal, but less so now than ever. I mean, women have a lot of power in that society, and that's been evolving over the last 100 years or more.
Well, yeah, you know, you mentioned the Iroquois. They were matriarchal as well. In fact, they had a tribal council, as you know, which was democratic, and it was all men who were the chiefs, but they were all chosen and could be removed by the women. And I saw a wonderful interview. This may be relevant to the Haida Gwaii. It's an interview with a woman, an Iroquois woman. They asked her why, if the women ran the tribes, were the men the chiefs? And she said, well, it gives them something to do, and it makes them feel important.
I think that's true in a lot of native tribes around the world, actually. I mean,
yeah.
You go visit you know, a lot of tribal communities around the world, and you see the men sitting around smoking ganja and stuff like that, while the women are doing all the work. They're gathering the water, they're cooking, they're doing everything, and the men are sitting around deciding, you know, the future of the world, or, you know, some big power question that's irrelevant to them. And yeah, and that is what the women will say. We got to keep them busy, so we give them big hats to wear and feathers and.
Yeah, well, you and I, being veterans of the marriage institution, understand that very well.
Yes, we do.
Now, do you have a photographer that's going up there with you to take pictures?
There is. I don't need one because there is tons and tons of photography. But I don't think that's where I'm going to illustrate the book. There's a brilliant Haida comic book artist named Michael Yongalatis. And I'm hoping I can persuade him to illustrate this book as a running comic strip, which he's really brilliant at, as a way to illustrate the book. Haida art is wonderful, and he does these comic strips in a Haida art form. So that's why I'm sort of hoping to illustrate the book. There's tons of photography. There doesn't need to be any more. And besides, this isn't a photo book. It's a strategic playbook for Native people.
Now, is there any evidence, and this is a question I hate to ask, but I'm sure it's on the minds of some of my listeners. Is there any evidence of contamination from Fukushima in these islands? We've got to do this quick. We're about to leave.
No, I don't think so.
All right, good. Mark Dowry, thank you so much for being with us. I'm going to have you back to talk about your fantastic career. Give us the website real quick for your project.
No, just go to Inkshares.
All right, Mark Dowry, thank you so much. Enjoy Point Reyes. We'll be back next week.